Washington Square On Air is the audio town square for the Washington Square Review, Lansing Community College's literary journal. Writers, readers, scholars, publishing professionals, citizens of the world, gather here and chat about all things writing. Hey there, this is Melissa Ford-Luckin, editor for the Washington Square Review. I'm here today with Jericho Wagon, who's the grandson of Bill Wagon. Bill Wagon was the creator of the Katie Keene Comics, which was a branch of the Archie Comics. Hey, Jericho.
Hello, good morning.
Hi.
So I'm Jericho Wagon. My grandfather was Bill Wagon, and he did Katie Keene Comics starting in 1945. I've sort of like, guess you could say, inherited the archive for the moment to go through the archive. And that's why I'm here today to talk to you guys about my grandfather's archive and the work I've been doing.
All right. Let's give people a little context for Katie Keene, because some people may not be familiar with where she came from. So back us up about 70 years.
Yeah, exactly. So in 1945, I'll go beyond that. In 1927, my grandfather was 16 years old, and he got his first job at a department store working as a art director. So I guess he must have quit high school, because in 1927, at age 16, he already got a full-time job working at the department store as essentially art director, drawing everything from garbage cans to girdles, and then so everything in between. So because of his brother, Elmer Wagon. Elmer was born in 1898, and Elmer was a what they call platinum age cartoonist. So he started pre-golden age cartooning from a correspondence course. So that's how my grandfather, Bill Wagon, got his start, because he was inspired by his older brother, Elmer. So Katie Keene got started, I would say, for sure, she debuted in Wilbur number 5 in 1945, and that's a comic book called Wilbur. So it was published by Archie Comics at the time. It was called MLJ Comics. So that being said, in 1945, Katie Keene debuted, and Grandpa quickly got, you know, the comic going. She was just a, let's say, like a three-pager within other comic books like Wilbur and Archie. And then she got her own title shortly thereafter. So by, like, let's say 1947, I'm just guessing, a couple of years after she started in other comic books, she had her own title, Katie Keene Comics. And that began a incredible journey where Grandpa did a thing where he would let kids draw fashions and designs for whatever they felt like sending in. So he did a call out, essentially, in the old days in the comics. He would actually have them send in their designs to him and then write their addresses and all their information, their personal name and stuff, because he encouraged like fans to be friends with fans and form fan clubs and all that kind of stuff. So this is all, of course, pre-internet. And
pre-telephone.
Yeah. So he really got them going and got the kids inspired to create and create in a really dedicated fashion. Some of the kids would send in literally hundreds of designs, and some of them, you know, may or may not have made it into the final cut, but he would essentially have his team, you know, he had a few people that worked with him, assistants and whatnot, to, one was Cassie Bill and Hazel Martin, two ladies that worked with my grandfather, as well as Floyd Norman. And so it really just was a sort of a family business, I would say. Grandpa kept it real simple and fun, and they moved to Santa Barbara in 1948. So that's kind of when he moved Katie Keene literally and figuratively to Hollywood, California. That way she would have a Hollywood address. So he took a mailing address, a Hollywood mailing address, which is really fun, for the kids to send in a letter to Hollywood, to Katie Keene in Hollywood, California. So that's the start.
So Katie Keene herself, as she shows up in the comics, is a model and an aspiring actress. So she does, she's very fashionable, and she wears a lot of different fashions, which makes sense that kids would want to draw the fashions and send them in.
Yeah.
And I think that's really amazing to think that this was, there probably were telephones, but it's not anything.
Of course, yeah.
Right. It's like, it's that long ago. So they would literally draw them on a sheet of paper, fold them up, put them in an envelope, and then dress it and send it, which is just fascinating to think, because back then kids weren't connected like they are to each other, to the world. And so the mailbox was really their only connection to communicate with other people, you know,
for sure.
And I think that's really fascinating. And so she, on the pages, would be wearing all these different outfits, and then would also have like the paper doll pages where she would show up, you know, wearing like one cute outfit, and then there'd be a bunch of outfits around her that the idea was that with the paper dolls, you could cut out the little outfits and then swap them out.
Exactly.
Yeah. So that was really unique. One of the things I've wondered about, and I know we're going to talk about the actual archive that you inherited. Mm-hmm. Do you know how it is that your grandfather was able to get his own kind of imprint? Because that was fairly unusual, because usually back then there would be a comic like Archie Comics or Superman, and there would be multiple people and different artists and different writers that would work on the storylines. But Katie Keene was really his vision and his comic. So do you know how that happened?
Well, I'm assuming he did work for Archie Comics prior to Katie Keene. There's a comic called Dotto and Diddy, or Diddy and Dotto. And then he did Millie the Monster and a few other characters prior to Katie Keene. So he was a part of, like, I would say, the company in a sense. Like, he was in Ohio. Toledo, Ohio was his home base. And he worked from, I'm guessing from home, because they would send things to New York for the publisher to deal with, you know, the process of making the comic book. But once he got the popularity up for Katie, because it was that kind of thing where the reality hit to Archie when they were receiving so much fan mail, because Grandpa was doing that, you know, submission, send me drawings for Katie. The company said, how about you just take the fan mail and you deal with the fan mail as well as dealing with the paper dolls? Mm-hmm. So he was able to essentially set up what they call nowadays a side hustle, which is basically the paper doll mail order business he set up. And it was like send 25 cents, even 10 cents for a paper doll. And then he would send them back a really nice piece of paper with Katie Keene on it that you could cut that out. And that could become like essentially like your paper version of like a Barbie doll. Mm-hmm. And then you could use the fashions that were in the comic book to cut them out and put them on, like you said, the paper doll thing. So it just became so successful that Archie was like, you do the paper dolls. You take care of the fan club. It's your baby. Mm-hmm. And of course, once the title had established itself, it was definitely like the American dream completely unfolding before my grandfather's eyes. And then, of course, moving to Santa Barbara, which is an hour and a half from Hollywood, and he got Wagon Wheels Ranch. He bought a small piece of property in Santa Barbara. But at the time, it was like, you know, just the dream kind of a deal. And so that's that part of it. So the success, I think, drove it to become something that, of course, also him essentially also pioneering working remotely, because he wasn't saddled up in New York next to the publisher or something, you know. So that I think there probably was for sure some artists. I'd have to research like Dan DiCarlo and a few other artists who work for Archie, whereabouts they lived in their life. Mm-hmm. I imagine there was a few by choice that lived close to the publisher. I mean, how convenient would that be to just literally walk your work to work or something after you finished it, you know? So, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's my theory.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
I think it's notable when you look at the Katie Keene comics, you can tell the distinct style carries through consistently.
And
I think that's one of the things that appealed to readers. I have talked to a lot of mostly women that read them as a kid, and they talk about always just hanging on to them. Like other comics, they would trade and share, but their Katie Keene ones, they would like hide them, you know, in their closet or, you know, on their bookshelf, and they wouldn't let anyone else touch them or, you know, even
that's
look
awesome.
At them. Yeah. It's very sweet. And so,
yeah, for sure.
They have a lot of good and unique memories with the Katie Keene ones.
Definitely.
All right. So you inherited a unorganized archive. Tell us about that. How did that happen?
Yeah. Well, basically, whenever I went to Grandpa's house, you know, he would always encourage me, of course, as a young artist, like, how's your art going? Are you collecting a file? You know, things like that. But to me, it was like he definitely left me with his morgue file, which is a artist's essentially like three filing cabinets full of imagery that he collected specifically for subject matter. Like if it was a giraffe, a cat, a dog, a love scene, New York, any subject that you would think of, essentially it would nowadays Google it. Mm-hmm. I kind of call it like grandpa's internet. So I first got his morgue file, like I said, the three filing cabinets full of imagery. I occasionally went in there to the file to, you know, maybe make a love letter or whatever for a girl or something, draw a cute card for Christmas or something for my mom or whatever. So using it as that reference file. And then I'd call from my cousin, Nancy, and that's Sis the Candy Kid in the comic book, which is Katie Keene's sister, because it's just Katie and Sis are pretty much the two characters. So Susie, my aunt, was getting ready to move to assisted living. My cousin called me and said, hey, we're down here at Susie's house. We're cleaning some things up. We found these films And there's a bunch of stuff, of course. And I'm like, I'll be right down. So more or less, I went down there. In short order, it became apparent that my cousin Nancy was going to go back east and go work, you know, with her husband, you know, back home. And what was left was my aunt by herself at home with a, you know, literally like a lifetime of paperwork that had, she thankfully, my aunt, had the wherewithal and the foresight to gather the archive, bring it to her home. She did sort of establish an office, I want to say, for grandpa's stuff, like all in one room. Thankfully, they had a 5-bedroom house. So I then went down to my aunt's house, almost like religiously, if you will, to separate and extract grandpa, like an archaeological dig, digging for artifacts, literally right. like through, you know, because the people that were pre-internet had a lot of paperwork, mm-hmm. essentially. So whether it was like a Time magazine from the 70s or whether it's a piece of mail from last week or a piece of mail from 1927, it was literally like that kind of a situation. Uh-huh. So I got everything separated. I made a box for each family member, especially boxing up grandpa, got them separated. I did move the entire archive to Los Angeles to my art studio at the time.
How big was it, though? How many boxes are we talking here?
We're talking like basically, I would say, a regular Chevy van or Ford van, whatever, full of banker boxes. Uh-huh. So you'd have to have a van for sure, because in a truck, it would literally be, it's high. So I would say if you put it on pallets, it would probably be like 3 pallets stacked. Of boxes. Uh-huh. So it's no joke, like the volume. I did rent a small moving truck, like a small budget or rider truck, to bring the archive to Colorado. It also contains 3 drawing boards, the original drawing boards that they used, essentially like a drafting table. So 3 drafting tables and a couple chairs. They're little wood chairs that you sit in while you're drawing. So like the kit, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so it's a volume of stuff. So at one point, my cousin had established a new relationship and the timing was perfect. I essentially pitched the idea like, hey, I'm kind of in a position where I'm ready to take over the archive and get to work on it. And he's like, you know, that's a great idea. Literally, I think the day after I moved out and got the office empty in California, my cousin's new fiance was able to establish her office in that room. So, you know, it's like timing was perfect. So I brought it out to Colorado and I literally called a landlord here in Colorado, in Pagosa Springs. I got a lease on an office space. I moved it directly from the moving truck up to the office. Probably took me 5 or 6 hours to bring all the boxes upstairs, blah, blah, blah. Got it all set. It was nice to be in a single room with the project. Finally, mm-hmm. you know, after years, because this has been going on since 2018. So that's how long I've been involved in it. You know, the COVID thing was it did break me off the project, mm-hmm. unfortunately. So this is like after COVID.
Okay. Yeah. Before you go on, let me ask you this. Yeah. What was it about the project that seemed most important to you? Like, why did you feel it needed to be done?
Well, Grandpa's dedication to the kids, the fans, and he also is a Will Eisner Award recipient, which is the comic book equivalent of an Oscar. And so I knew that if it was me as an artist, because myself being an artist, mm-hmm. if I had left my work behind, I would want someone to essentially, because once you achieve a certain level within art, in the art world, let's say, you are a part of a special group of people that do get taken care of. Essentially, your work gets preserved and then moved forward to museums. Mm-hmm. And that's my goal, is mm-hmm. to get the work probably to the Billy Ireland Cartoon Art Museum in Ohio. That's one. Perhaps something in Santa Barbara, I'm not sure yet. There's definitely George Lucas has a museum in Los Angeles. So there's a few potential. There's also a museum in San Francisco, a Cartoon Art Museum, that has some of his work already. Mm-hmm. So he, before his passing, my grandfather had established contacts with museums because he was essentially already doing it. So I'm just taking over where he left off mm-hmm. to get the archive moved forward and into the museums. So that's my goal.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
That matches up totally. With what I was thinking earlier. As I was saying, with the Katie Keene comic, it is so distinctly his. How, you know, mm-hmm. when you compare it to the Archies, they have different artists, they have different writers. So those are all blended together. But when you look mm-hmm. at the Katie Keene's, you're really getting one artist's vision more so yeah. than with the other
Definitely.
Ones. So that's, yeah. that makes it really unique and a different kind of comic to be able to study, I think.
Right, for sure. And he was like kind of like the ultimate boss man. Yeah, they actually called him boss man, Bill Loggins, you know, that whole thing. It's sort of a joke. Uh-huh. He had a good sense of humor. But with Cassie Bill, Hazel Martin, these two incredible women worked with my grandfather as his assistants. And they also, I believe Cassie Bill if not Hazel Martin, or both of them were incredible illustrators in their own right. Mm-hmm. And one of them actually came from the fashion industry herself. So their line work, their attention to detail on the lace and the fabrics and all those beautiful things that make Katie Keene so special. Mm-hmm. It was like, it was drawn in with, I would say, a woman's perspective, a woman's sense of style and unique nature. And my grandfather was definitely like art director, mm-hmm. and of course illustrator as well. Like, he would ink everything, I guess, for the most part. I mean, so that's what I know in terms of how it was created. It was all pen and ink, essentially pencil drawn first and then inked after. And then after it was inked, it was essentially mailed to New York. Mm-hmm. And then grandpa would go to, a favorite restaurant and have a cocktail after or something, you know?
Yeah,
so it's definitely like the Mad Men era, pre-Mad Men. Uh-huh. It was like, this is what these guys did. So, yeah.
Yeah. I was thinking about what you were saying with that, that had a woman's perspective with the, you know, uh-huh. the fashions and the, just yeah. the details and the touches. And that is also mm-hmm. something that's distinct when you compare mm-hmm. it to many of the other comics didn't have that kind of woman's input perspective.
Right. Yeah. And later on, what was so amazing is that Mary Lise Flusser, she actually worked for Saks Fifth Avenue in 1978. She was going to like little like flea markets and swaps and stuff and reminiscing about her childhood. Cause then at that time she was probably 20 something. Mm-hmm. And so she was like, God, I wonder what happened to all the fans from Katie Keene. So she actually wrote 500 letters to old addresses that were in the comics from the early 40s, 50s, 60s. She wrote a, sort of a chain letter. She just made one, Xeroxed it, and sent it to 500 addresses. And mm-hmm. she got a tremendous response, which then she found John Lucas, who was a contributing artist back then, and Craig Levitt was also a contributing artist. So now these young people that were teens and tweens in the 40s and 50s and 60s were now full-fledged professional young artists mm-hmm. Working in different industries. And so they, with the help of Craig Levitt and John Lucas and Barbara Rausch, the fans from the day, with Mary Lise's sort of get after it, get it done. Mary Lise was also a writer. She wrote a kind of a tell-all in the Soho Weekly 1978 and for New York, like an everything about Katie Keene, and interviewed a bunch of people like Betsy Johnson. I don't think she got Calvin Klein, but she did get Antonio. So prominent fashion designers of the day to get on record saying that Katie Keene was their inspiration for their beginning of their careers, essentially, and what they also reflected back to in their current designs and things like that. So really special in terms of the tie into history and the mm-hmm. timing. Mm-hmm. So there's that.
A very long lasting community of artistic
creatives.
Yeah,
dedicated for sure. And so they're just total dedication to inspiration from the past. And thankfully they were of age to be like, again, that those professional positions. And Mary Lise had every intention of writing a book. And that's another thing. What she did by getting the Soho Weekly article published, that really cemented in the who's who of the early era and got their words done. And then that got grandpa, like the phone started ringing again after it hadn't rang for 20 years, perhaps, because Katie Keene stopped when kids started to watch television. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the comic book era kind of faded a bit mm-hmm. for a second. So they actually canceled Katie in like 1962 or something like that. But then by 78, that leads into Katie Keene's comeback, mm-hmm. which is the early 80s Katie Keene comeback. And that was brought on by the fans. And then especially John Lucas as an illustrator. I think my grandfather was a part of the beginning where they would reissue old comics again, and that got the fans back. And essentially Katie Keene had like a tremendous like comeback then. And then grandpa got the Inkpot Award in 1981. And then Comic-Con really kicked on, because I think Comic-Con really turned on in the 70s. And by the 80s, it was fully going. And now it's in the 90s. It's just growing and growing, the San Diego Comic-Con. Mm-hmm. So now it's like a lifestyle for mm-hmm. people, you know,
yeah.
with cosplay. Yeah. So
yeah, for sure. All right, so let's let's go back to the boxes.
Yeah, talk to me.
You get all the boxes, they're in
Help
a room.
Me, yeah.
What
yeah.
do you do first?
Oh my God. Well, basically what I have come to terms with, the reality of it is, and what my goal now, and I did get recently 100 three-ring binders. Uh-huh. And so what I had a friend come to help me, and that really focused me to prepare for work. In a very calculated way. And what I worked on with him primarily was the morgue file. So basically going into those files, which are literally like actual paper files, and like manila folder full of a subject matter. Mm-hmm. And what we're doing is putting the, let's say it's giraffes, just using that subject, all the pictures of giraffes go into the plastic sheet protectors. Mm-hmm. And whether there's two pictures or one picture to be determined, whatever, but you basically put it in the slip sleeve, put it into the three-ring binder, label the front of the binder with what subjects are in that binder, and then move on to the next file. Mm-hmm. So when you have probably, I'm guessing, 200 pages in each three-ring binder, you're getting somewhere. I have not yet finished the morgue file yet, but that's a good goal to have the entire, because it's sort of like an Encyclopedia Britannica, if you will, mm-hmm. of the old days, of every subject under the sun. Yep. I mean, we're talking, you know, like I said, mentioned New York. Of course, there's like definitely women's fashion, men's fashion, because he started this thing in pre-1927. I imagine he came to work in 1927 at age 16, prepared to work, and then therein started to collect imagery. Mm-hmm. So back then it was, you had to cut each little image out and keep it in a file. So it's I think, I'm guessing when it's all said and done, I'll have 300 binders. Maybe it'll be 30,000 pages. I don't know. Right. I mean, you know, Fina, because I know I've spent, it's a personal like passion project, if you will. I'm just going at it like, hey, I have to get this done. It is costing me to do the project, mm-hmm. but it's worth it because it's all about the presentation. So when I'm ready to present it, I'll be presenting binders with labels on the front, and it's all handwritten. I'm very analog. At least it'll be, you can flip the pages. So that's kind of it. Look at a subject, pull a subject, flip the pages, whether it's interviews, interviewees like us today, mm-hmm. except back then this interview would have been done and published in a comic book paper doll reader or mm-hmm. Those type of things. So mm-hmm. thankfully with the internet, we can get on it. So I'd love to go live every day with the archive. And I did do a show for a second. We did 114 episodes of okay. Coffee with the Summerland Kids. Yep. And I dressed this way and, you know, talked about grandpa as much as I could. I had a picture of my grandfather behind me, and uh-huh. that's what we did. So I am the face of the project. Uh-huh. And so here I am. Yeah. Representing Bill Walgan. Yeah.
What kind of surprises did you find in the boxes?
Oh, there's some incredible stuff. I mean, it's like, you know, there may be a few risque things in there, you know, definitely. Only very few. You know, of course, there's the history of cars. There's a history of course, fashion history. There's an incredible, like, Western cowboys, cowgirls, Indians. It's like sort of like the history of America, essentially, in a nutshell, I'd say, too, mm-hmm. Which is fascinating. So it's you're learning, and that's one thing I've always kind of realized. It's like I'm learning and taking on this information, whether I know I'm taking in or not. Because when you're holding something, looking at something, even if it's just for a brief moment, you're absorbing it. So as an artist, that's kind of it. I'm just exposing myself to the grandeur of what someone specifically kept for a purpose. Mm-hmm. So it's intense. Yeah.
What are your next steps?
I'm thinking, you know, something like 600 hours, perhaps, if you condense it with two people. That'd be great. It's all about man hours. And of course, and I'm not the best at math, but I do know that when you have two people working on something at the same time, you kind of get you get it done faster. I
mean, you should.
You know, yeah. I mean, two humans in a room working together for 3 hours is 6 man hours. So that I like those numbers. I like 4 hours. I could do 4 hours a day. Uh-huh. I mean, I have a life I want to live outside of this too, because I'm anxious to get back to my work mm-hmm. and complete finish grandpa to be able to present, like, for example, get you and my cousin and whoever to look at. Let's preview the project mm-hmm. or preview the archive prior to someone showing up to essentially say, oh, what's the value of this? Mm-hmm. You know, it's like having American pickers out, but having them out when they're able to. Yeah. Right. When they can look at binders of information mm-hmm. versus a box of papers full of papers, you're going, what are these papers?
Right.
You know, hello. You know, so that's what I'm up against.
It has more of a scholarly value when it's mm-hmm. all assembled.
When it's all assembled.
Yeah. So it's not really, not even a market value, but more of like a value of a contribution to people that want to study art. And
that's exactly right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you for that. That's the most important thing for me. That's mm-hmm. That's my heart. My heart is then in those words that you just said, that is where my heart is mm-hmm. in this whole thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's all about academia, all about learning, and all about the future fans, the fans now, to be able to, you know, research it, like what you're doing when you go to the colleges or these, mm-hmm. you know, pop culture institutions. That's what it's all about for me. So, you know, other aspects of the project, there, of course, there is a bottom line and there is a reality. And perhaps someone will pay for it because they want to be the person that holds the information. I mean, that's that's a little bit beyond my scope, but I know that's a part of it. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk for a couple minutes about your, you as an artist, because
thank you.
Tell us a little bit about the art that you do.
Well, the, one of the things I do is I, this is a funny little fashion thing, but I make these ties and I sign them on the back. This is in white, but nonetheless. So I get tires from cars and I roll over the ties with tires to create the print essentially. So that's one little funny thing I came up with a while back ago. So I've always been interested in art, of course, and I started doing fabric painting in I would say the 90s. I worked on cars in high school. That kind of carried through as a career. I told a friend today I probably would have, if I was a little more straight-laced in my early teens and tweens and 20s, I probably would have gone straight to art school. But I was trained, essentially formal training, by the men I worked with at the at a place called, one of them was the Prototype Source, where they built Cars of the Future. We worked on, they did do a wind tunnel model for the Oscar Mayer Wiener Mobile, which is hilarious. And then they did the Hershey Kissmobile, the Planters Peanut Hot Rod. they did a concept car for Volkswagen, the new Beetle, the bug, essentially, as you see it today.
Okay.
Was essentially, the prototype was completed at the company that I work for. Mm-hmm. So working with clients like Pfizer, Hershey, Audi, Volkswagen, Chevy, Pontiac, you know, all those major companies. So essentially I worked at a company that was doing design work for them and creating prototypes. And so that was an amazing hands-on activity. So I was very like blessed. So I took my own work to Los Angeles in 2004. I did Burning Man 2003. And then 04, I did Coachella Music Festival, or 04, 05, 06. And those years were very pivotal in the EDM, electronic music world. Mm-hmm. There's a video with, that's when Daft Punk took their pyramid and took it to Coachella and did their thing in the Sahara tent. And it's like a notable moment. And my work was outside. And that year, Coachella asked me to make my work 400 feet long. I thought that was completely crazy because previously it was 138 feet long. So to grow it like triple the size overnight. So I did that on budget. They did give me a budget, thankfully, to enlarge the work. Mm-hmm. And so by working with Coachella Music Festival, Music and Art Festival, that's how I kind of found them, because they were advertising themselves as a music and art festival. So I'm like, what's up with that? Mm-hmm. And so I found them and they asked me, what's it going to take to make this happen? I said camping passes and event passes. Uh-huh. And they said, I think we can do this. Because I didn't want to put anything in between me and making the project happen.
Uh-huh. Maybe you should have asked for snacks too, though. Snacks and water.
Yeah, well, they did put us up in the artist camping area, which essentially is you pitch a tent on the grass. Uh-huh. But nonetheless, I did get involved in the music industry, music festival industry, I should say. I did the Baltimore Virgin Music Festival. The Beastie Boys played. I think Sting played. Amy Winehouse. So it was amazing to be essentially that year. Also, the people at the Baltimore Virgin Music Festival had me bookend the stage left and right with my art. So it was really magical and special to be taken into, essentially, these festivals are like families of people building these festivals. So blessed in that way. And I always took a real professional kind of look and feel of my crew. I would make my own crew outfits and hats and t-shirts and things to distinguish us as these guys are together. They're part of the crew kind of thing. So I just loved to do it that way. And that helped. And then I went towards the art galleries and did at Burt Green Gallery, downtown Los Angeles, and also MoNA, the Museum of Neon Art, because I've done a lot of my work. Most famous stuff is blacklight art installations. So I've definitely kind of have a multifaceted love for, you know, furniture design, of course, car stuff, but fashion, art installation work, which is a weird thing. Kind of like Christo is known as an art installation artist. He did the gates in New York and an umbrella project in California as well, in Japan at the same time. So there's many different artists that inspire me, of course. So art and artists and art galleries and art lofts and just that life. Is I pretty much dedicated myself to the artist's life. It's not always very financially beneficial.
Right. Yes, as a writer, I hear that.
So that's the reality, but our heart is in it, and that's what matters.
Right.
Know, so, yeah.
Right. That's beautiful. Anyways,
yeah, totally.
All right. So
well, it's amazing to chat with you today.
Yeah, people want to find you online. Where can they find you?
You can find me on Instagram. I'm Jericho101. also on Instagram at installationart.jericho. And then, of course, on Facebook, just my name, Jericho Wagon.
All right. Good deal. Yeah. Thanks a lot for coming on and talking to me today.
Absolutely. Thank you. Yeah. Cheers.
Thanks for stopping by the Audio Town Square of the Washington Square Review. Until next time, this has been the Washington Square On Air from Lansing Community College. To find out more about a writer's community and literary journal, visit lcc.edu/WSR. Writing is messy, but do it anyway.